Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me is Steve.
Hey, John, how are you?
Good, good. And we have Sean.
Hey, John, can't believe it's already February.
Oh, that's right. You've made it this far. Congratulations. Very busy 2021 so far. Kind of like the 2020 part two, the Coronas Reawakens and new craziness. Have you
What
guys heard about
craziness?
anything with
What?
this, what, GameStop thing I've heard
What is.
about?
You mean that one brick and mortar store I used to go to when, like, before Blockbuster when I was a kid?
Brick and mortar. Yeah, that's, you make it sound really old school, but it's actually now at the cutting edge of what fintech can do to the markets and some people's financial lives. It's a little bit crazy.
Certainly an exciting story, John. I mean, this was really just exemplary of how the new age of traders are trying to really take over Wall Street and trying to give them a run for their money. Obviously the Wall Street Bets Forum is causing a lot of buzz. Did you end up signing up, John, for Wall Street Bets? I thought you were maybe going to get in that.
I actually did
Oh,
for the memes. The memes are outstanding. I love the memes.
I bet a
nice.
little bit toxic, I hear. I haven't been on there myself.
Well,
Signed up
I think
maybe.
some of
Yeah.
the language that they use can be a little bit edgy or a bit meme lordish. But we should really get into the actual scandal. So what happened is that, in case you've been under a rock for the past 2 weeks or so, a bunch of retail investors on Wall Street Bets basically banded together, and they actually did some analysis, and they concluded that GameStop, which was heavily shorted, actually had some potential to grow. And they said, "We believe in the stock. This is good to do it." And then this whole thing kind of snowballed into this movement where people from really all over the world, like I've seen comments of people from South Korea, Germany, France, Chile, buying into the stock from their home countries so they can pump up the price. And the stock price was basically, I think, at about $5 or $7 in early January, and it went all the way up to 460 something dollars. It's now since crashed down. It's now since gone back down into I think the mid 200s as we speak now, but it's been a really wild ride. And this has a lot of really interesting implications for things like, the role of social media in organizing, the role of tech platforms like Robinhood, regulatory capture as well, which I'm going to get into with my final bite. But really a multifaceted story that just has so much.
Oh, and so much for the regulators and politicians to dive into as well. Some market manipulation, if you want to call it that, but kind of like a strange thing for a popular movement. When this comes crashing down because there's no fundamentals behind it, I mean, this is going to be kind of, a thumb at Wall Street, but kind of at your own cost when you're the last one holding the bag.
But I think a lot of the people who are posting on there just say, we can be irrational for longer than you can be liquid. They say that to the hedge funds, which is a really funny way of saying that, for them, even if you lose, say, $5,000, $10,000, it's for them, it's worth the satisfaction of having hedge funds lose all this money. Although I suspect, with the way that hedge funds are so sophisticated nowadays, that some of them are actually reversing their position. If they were short, they're probably long now, or they had been long for a bit. So some of them, I assume, kind of rode the wave and led to the increase in price.
I think it's going to be so interesting to see how the government really lays down the law here, or if they do. Interesting. I think the most interesting question is this a form of market manipulation? Or is this people just publicly around a public square, a virtual public square, saying, "Hey, look, like marketing for a stock. Hey, here's GameStop." There's an argument to be made by these Redditors to say, "Look, we're not trading on, information that's not public. We are simply banding together to pump up a company that hedge funds are taking advantage of the other side of that bet." So it's an interesting kind of dynamic here. The outcome of this regulatory action, or pending regulatory action, I think it's going to be really exemplary and symbolic of how the government treats these problems going forward. Another interesting thing I saw was, people from across the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, coming together and talking specifically about how Hedge funds are actually unfairly reaping the benefits of market movements, and a lot of times siding with the people. And that this kind of goes to the democratization of finance, which we kind of seen as a general trend in fintech. So be interesting to see how this pans out.
How do you think this will affect Robinhood's potential IPO, their valuation, and sort of their prospects in the future? They have obviously were a core part of this whole thing, but I think that there's maybe some distrust from retail investors because of the whole issue with Citadel. But how will they fare after this whole thing is over?
Well, first you have to laugh a little bit at the hedge funds who are going to cry. These poor billionaires finally lost money on one of their bets when somebody stood up to them. Now, I think the Wall Street bets thing is crazy, but not a whole lot of sympathy for wealthy hedge fund managers who are making their own market manipulation and profiteering that they've done for a long time. I think this does have a wide implications for Robinhood. I think this is the last thing that they wanted to see for sure, because it brings the spotlight really sharply on them from politicians, from the SEC, who's going to be looking at them, FINRA, all of the market regulators. They're going to be looking at the gamification of trading. So that's a big question right now, whether they're incentivizing poor risk decisions, uninformed people. I'm sure a lot of people who are investing in GameStop and the other AMC and the other companies, if they keep moving on to do this, is this responsible investing for your clients? I mean, if they're wealthy, that's one thing, but if people are putting their life savings in, that's not something we want people to do, gamble that way with money they don't have, or maybe even are borrowing. But so the SEC is going to come down on them. And who is it that approves the IPOs? Oh yes, the SEC. I know they continue to raise money. They got first $1 billion and then $2.4 billion to
They've raised
support their
$3.5
operations.
billion since this whole thing broke, which is amazing. So I think
Right,
it's
between
a testament to how. Right.
those two
So
rounds.
they're still getting a lot of traction from investors, but to your point, I am not sure that the SEC will look at sort of the way in which they've done business in the past. That's all settled in terms of them, branding an account, checking account when it wasn't, doing things like gamifying trading. But I think honestly, the horse is out of the barn with this. Robinhood is one player that's really popularized this free trade model. But there are many others who are not doing it. Companies like Public, I think SoFi also is doing the same thing. So this is the new normal. The question is, I think, will there
I
be a
don't think that's
change?
true. There's going to be
No.
new rules. So the regulators aren't stuck with what they're doing now. They can make a lot more restrictions, make it harder for option trading, which has been one of the drivers of stock market volatility, not just with this, but in general, because it magnifies your investment. And so I think that there's going to be a lot more stricter policies on getting those option trading approvals through your broker dealer. You're going to really have to show that you can make these kinds of investments, that you understand what you're doing. So like I said, Robinhood doesn't want to see this. They want to they promote everybody trading everything pretty much. I mean, in different vehicles to invest, futures, options, other kinds of derivatives. A lot of these people don't really understand how they work. They know the effect. They can see what it does, but they don't have risk management. They don't know what will happen if fundamentals move. There's not that deep understanding. So I think the SEC is going to look at that, and I think we will see some new rules, especially from them, and FINRA to a lesser extent on this kind of trading, because it's not what the SEC is defining what the markets are for.
So I agree with that, but I think that there may be some restrictions in terms of the options and the margin costs as well that we see on all these platforms. But the notion of free trades and potentially the ability or the potential of all these kind of runs being coordinated on social media will still be here. There's nothing that the SEC can do to tamp this down because this is, this what happened with GameStop is, although they want to call it market manipulation, I think that it's actually just people on a public forum discussing their strategies and their thinking on this.
On how
There's
to
nothing.
manipulate a stock price. That's
I don't know if it's.
manipulation.
I don't
They
know if
want to
it's.
drive it up
It's.
artificially.
No. So actually,
That's almost the definition of
there's
manipulation.
actually there's a very fine legal distinction of this term, and it's not just let's bring this stock price up. It has to do with access to the market, which stuff is out of public view. So it's kind of different. I think that people banding together and saying let's make GameStop go to the moon, it's not really market manipulation in the legal sense. And I think that that's where some of the rules that may affect this, but it's ultimately kind of a tricky question. But again, my thinking on this is that now that we have other companies that are jumping on the bandwagon of free trades, we'll see a lot more of this stuff, unless, as you say, John, we can scale back on some of the riskier things like margins and options.
So the SEC has their own rules. They don't have a, there's not a law saying what the market manipulation is. It's their own regulations. So if they change the rule, then you're manipulating. And if you're doing a conspiracy to manipulate, then
But how is it a
for
conspiracy if
Robinhood.
you and I can see it? If you and I can log onto Reddit and see how we're
No,
which
it doesn't
stock we
have
think
to
they want
be
to
in
buy next.
secret. Like if two, banks announce that they're gonna collaborate to restrict lending somewhere, they're just being stupidly breaking the law by doing it in public. It's public or not public, is that's not relevant to breaking a law.
I think the most interesting thing here with like what GameStop or what happened with Robinhood was they overtly limited the users to execute one side of each transaction. So they there was a point where they only allowed customers to buy one share of GameStop stock and five options contracts. They restricted, one side of the order book, and I think generally, there's unanimous consent that this is, or at least amongst what my circles, that this is not a fair trading practice. I get why they did it, but it's not fair because people should be able to trade the stocks and trade the options that they want at the prices they want, or at the given price that's available. And for an exchange to limit that sort of behavior is unfair. I think that there's certainly an argument to be made there.
Well, Robinhood didn't restrict because of that. They ran out of cash, so that's why
Right,
they
and
had to raise
they
that 3.45 billion
yeah.
dollars. So they kind of got, as far as I can tell, I don't think they did that on purpose that way. And also, their clearinghouse has certain rules too. So
Right.
it wasn't like a policy or they were taking somebody's side. They just literally would have collapsed. If they didn't restrict that trading, they just didn't have a choice.
Yeah, I think there was a massive conspiracy theory basically saying that because a lot of the payment for order flow went from Robinhood to Citadel, and Citadel was on the losing side of the short, that they basically pressured Robinhood to stop the trading on this and to put a cap on how much options their users could buy. But actually, what came out recently is that this was a directive from the DTCC, the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, that basically told Robinhood that given the volume of trades that they were initiating, they needed to have they needed capital requirements for liquidity. So that's why they ended up raising $3.5 billion to cover all this stuff.
I think there's something to be said, though, about Robinhood being more prepared for situations like this because they would have been risking to being insolvent, which is a very big deal. And I understand why they did that. But you can also understand from the consumer's perspective. The consumer is the one, I think, getting the short end of the sticks here, in this case, because they wanted to get out of their position. They just simply couldn't do it. I get why they did it, but I also think that, these companies should be more mindful of what. What are the possible bad outcomes that could happen in preparing more for the worst case scenario here?
I think that's a little bit of consumers not doing their research too. I mean, you're going to a brand new internet free stock trading company that's had outages, and you're kind of making an emotional rather than a rational choice. You're not going with your JP Morgan or your E-Trade even or your Charles Schwab, which are reliable. They have the capital. They wouldn't have to go ask for money to do this. They're ready for this kind of thing. But if you're just like the Wall Street Bets trades, if you're not basing your decisions on logic and good compliance and reliable systems, then yes, sure, you're going to have some problems there. You didn't
But
do
their
your
UI is so
homework.
good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what the SEC
Confetti,
is
that confetti. Yeah.
concerned about, and some politicians are concerned about this gamification
Yeah.
aspect, is lulling, is distracting you from the risks that you're taking rather than making them more transparent. And so that might be a problem that they look at. And what they resolve, I'm not sure, but it's going to get a lot of scrutiny, which again, they didn't want. There's no way Robinhood is coming out well out of all this.
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out from a political angle too, because if anything happens in DC as a result of this, all the fintechs are watching. Everyone's going to go through these hearings with a fine-tooth comb and try to see if there are some hints as to how the both the Biden administration and kind of the next few years in Congress and the Senate are going to play out and treat these sorts of matters.
Yeah, that's a good point, because all these regulators for the SEC, OCC, FINRA, I mean, these are all people who are expected to be tougher on the banks and broker dealers, not softer. So again, not a great time for this to happen to Robinhood. But is anything else going on out there in the world of fintech?
Something that's not GameStop related. I just saw in the latest CB Insights quarterly fintech funding report that buy now, pay later as a category has really skyrocketed in popularity. And they say that buy now, pay later startups have grown their funding at a 93% clip since 2016.
A firm just went public through a SPAC, right? And their stock went up 2 times on the first day, 110%, I think it was,
It
up to
doubled, yeah.
like, yeah, up to like 20. They thought $10 billion was a large amount. I think it went up a few billion in the months before this SPAC IPO, but then it went up beyond that. Now, I don't know what the stock is. Have you seen what the stock is lately?
I haven't seen the Affirm stock lately, but I do know this is kind of a different question, but I do know that if you look at the top 10 countries in terms of market penetration of buy now, pay later, even though Affirm's stock price doubled since their IPO, the US is actually number 10 on the list. They're at the bottom of the top 10. The number one country for buy now, pay later is actually Sweden, which is really fascinating because they have such a well-developed payment system. In Sweden, 24% of e-commerce purchases are done through a buy now, pay later scheme.
Any predictions on why that's the case?
I don't know. I think again it has to be with the fact that they have a very sophisticated market. Maybe they have less credit card penetration than the US does. And also one of the big players in the space, Klarna, is actually Swedish, so that's really their home market. So the company's big in Sweden, Germany, I think Austria, basically in Scandinavia and in
Australia,
Western
yeah.
Europe. Yeah, so it just means
Also.
that that's sort of their home turf. That's the right market for this product.
Yeah, this is just starting out because even though some countries have a lot of penetration, the US is still really small. And these companies from Sweden and Australia, a few from Australia, have just been jumping into the US market. And I think it was, what was it, Citibank that's starting to offer a buy now, pay later related service. And there's variations. So some actually lend you the money, some offer to charge it on your credit card over a certain amount of time, and in that case, they're not making any loan. They're just going to use your own credit that you have already, and a lot of different things that they can do. Or I'm sure there's some they can use your debit card. It's not just one way that it works.
It's some way, and it's also interesting that the market may actually see some changes in the UK. So I think sometime this week, the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK, announced that they will be regulating to a greater extent nowadays the whole buy now, pay later market, because they see that a lot of consumers in the UK are becoming more indebted as they use the services more. So the average user in the UK has £1,000 in debt, or they're in the hock for that much, to a buy now, pay later service.
And it's kind of off the books, right? Like kind of a shadow banking. If they haven't charged your credit yet, it's like you owe it, but it doesn't show up anywhere. And I think that's part of the concerns. And you can get into trouble easier because you don't think it's that much, I guess.
So like an Experian or these other credit, like TransUnion stuff wouldn't pick up that you owe on a buy now, pay later platform. Is that right?
No, because it's not in the ecosystem. It's done basically between the the buy now pay later company, the vendor, and yourself. And I think that unless you default on it, they don't actually report that to the credit bureaus, because the whole thing is that they can do underwriting without actually going back and checking your FICO score. They look at other signals. I'm sure maybe do a soft pull depending on the amount, but it's not like you're opening a new credit line.
Yeah, it depends how
Oh,
they're
interesting.
structuring it too. If it's like an occasional payment from a debit card or a credit card, they're not giving you a loan or anything. But maybe there are some that where they're actually lending you the money. So in that case, maybe it does. But yeah, there's a lot of models.
Right.
The important thing is that I can get my Peloton today.
Yeah, I can't wait. I need to have it now.
All right, now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it. What do you got for us, Sean?
So my number is one. It's the amount of times that Ray Dalio has called Bitcoin a good invention. It's the first time he said anything really big, publicly positive around Bitcoin. And he's starting to say he's going to consider it for some new funds. And this is a watershed moment in the crypto space, because Ray Dalio is a legendary thinker. He's a really strong, a respected mind in finance. And now that he's looking to input cryptocurrency into two new funds, and now that he sees digital assets as having kind of this option like growth, it really paints a picture of like institutional adoption, which is kind of a pattern we've seen over the past few months. You may know Ray Dalio from Bridgewater Associates. He created this hedge fund that really dominated the space for years. His book Principles goes into everything that he has learned through his years and work and his personal life. And up until now, he has really said that there's a big unknown around Bitcoin, and he was really not for the asset class. But now he's really turned his tune here, and he's saying that there is an option for Bitcoin to be in his in some of his new funds. So let's see how that plays out.
Yeah, that's interesting. A few people in the past few years have mentioned this Principles for Success by him as kind of expanding their horizons a little bit. But he's been a very successful, he's a hedge fund that he has, right?
He has a hedge fund,
Correct.
and I think they're known for having what they call radical transparency, which is where essentially all the discussions take place in a very public forum. You can basically go up to like a senior VP and tell them how he or she have messed up, and the whole culture is created around calling people out and pointing out their mistakes so they can improve, but in a very public way.
Oh yeah, he's that guy. Okay, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, even the first day person can say something to the CEO, and they kept have this open full feedback going on all the time, or questioning of their ideas,
Right.
which is great. And it's unfortunate that that's so uncommon.
I don't know how it takes shape in sort of how that's practiced inside, but at least on principle, it sounds like a really good idea to have a flat, very open work environment.
I think as long as it's managed in a really like adult and mature way, and no one's getting, being passive aggressive or spiteful with their feedback, then I think it would go well. I just admire the first day joiner who gives a CEO feedback. I'd love to hear what that is.
Yes.
Yeah,
Hi, I'm the intern here. I have some suggestions for where we allocate our funds.
All right, Steve, what do you got for your final bite?
So my number is the story that just will never die, GameStop. And actually, that's not my number. My number is $810,000, which is dun dun dun. That is how much money the current Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen got from Citadel for delivering a couple of speeches and some
Those
webinars.
speeches, man, those are the big money makers once you get a top government job, huh? Or after you get a top government job.
They get them every time. It's basically it's this is I don't think this is controversial, but I think it's basically legalized bribery to be able to hire, say, Reagan for $10 million to go speak at a Japanese car plant, and then to have, the outgoing head of the Fed in Yellen give the speeches. And she also gave speeches to many, many other companies in the space. She gave speeches to Citibank, Goldman Sachs, all these Google, all these companies that that she would potentially have to have either power over or to or regulate. And the total sum that she got from the speeches, so from her departure of the Fed to now, is something like $7.2 million. Just
Yeah,
a
it's huge.
crazy, crazy
Yeah,
number.
those speaking deals. The other one is the book deal, right?
The book deal, I think, is less nefarious because that's less of a direct thing. But if you're speaking to, say, some high-level city executives or just the whole company, and then you have to turn around a year later and regulate them, I have to wonder whether that will affect your judgment. It's also troubling to say that she has basically said that she will not recuse herself from any of the conversations with the SEC or Treasury regarding GameStop, even though her former benefactor is on one side of this whole thing. So it's a bit troubling to say the least.
How many dollars per word is that, Steve?
Oh my God, that's such a good question.
I'm
No, several thousand
just trying
dollars
to
per
do the
word.
math right now, and it's
Yeah.
it looks pretty expensive.
It's pretty pricey. But I guess that's what you do to get access, right? In Russia, they call it bribery. Here, they call it access or speaking fees. What's your number, John?
Oh, well, my final bite is zero. And this is a repeat for me. I've been watching this zerodown.com. And I mentioned this one a while ago, pre-pandemic, about how this company, you sign up with them and they'll buy the house for you. You just pay them and you can just buy the house from them at any point over the next 3 years.
That's a pretty good deal, but
Wow.
is that the kind of product that would have worked better when the market in the Bay Area was a bit? I'm assuming that this is a national product, but will this work now that we are deprioritizing living in cities as a country and the market seems less hot at least? I don't know.
Well, we're not living in the woods yet. And this is working just in the mostly in the expensive areas. So the SF Bay Area, Austin, which has been booming, Dallas, Seattle, and Phoenix. And well, everywhere prices have just been going up like crazy. It's the same value proposition, I think, because they limit the amount of the cost increase to 2.5% per year. Which, if it was in the past year, would have saved you a lot of money because house prices have been going up much, much more than that. So the way it works is you give them $10,000. Let's get that out of the way up front. So it's not a
Step one.
charity, yeah. And then you give them. So they said that they'll buy the house right away in cash. So they're putting up a lot of capital. I don't know how much they can expand with their buying up one house per customer. Minimum 500 to $2 million or something like that. They handle the property taxes and insurance. And if you see the lease rates, you see that that's built in for sure. So just to give you an example, let me go to Austin, which has been going up a bit lately. So if you do a $500,000 house in Austin, Zero Down will buy it. You pay. Oh, actually, it's different. In Austin, it's a $5,000 starter cost.
Oh,
And
wow.
then you
Oh, wow.
pay $4,234 a month for your $500,000 home. And then let's say you buy in a year, you pay 500,000 times 1.025, and that's your new price that you would have had to you'll need to buy that house.
It seems like I haven't seen a lot of other place in real estate, but Sean, I don't know. Do you track the real estate market or these kind of products closely? Because I certainly don't.
I don't really closely, but John, you bring up an interesting kind of an interesting model here. Really, is the whole point of this to allow for people that don't have the capital for the down payment to be able to really achieve their goal as homeowners through a longer period of time as opposed to a lump sum down payment?
I think there's two variations or two big use cases. One, yeah, you don't have the down payment. So at the end of this, you can buy the home. You don't have to compete with anybody. So let's say you don't have anybody coming in to outbid you and drive up the house price. So you got that locked in and there's some predictability. And also you don't know if you're gonna like the house maybe. So if money's not the issue, you can kind of try out the house for a few months. And then if you figure, whoa, I'm glad I didn't buy this thing, you can just cancel and you're good to go. So it's flexible that way. You can just walk away from the deal if you don't like it. So I imagine, especially let's say that Your next job ends up being in Austin or Seattle or something, and you don't know the areas that well, so you can do a zero down kind of thing, try it out, get settled in right away. They'll take care of it in 2 or 3 weeks. They say as little as 2 weeks. So you have a house. If you end up liking it, you can buy it. If not, you'll kind of scope out the area and buy somewhere else that you would have liked better. So you're not committed.
Oh yeah. So it's sort of like in a way allowing the homeowner to be more educated about the area they're buying in by kind of test run conducting a test run on the locale, right?
That's certainly something I would consider if I'm moving to a new place. But when there's options like this, it kind of fills out the market a bit better so that people with particular needs, a particular offering that can get them in a house.
That's great. What an innovative concept.
Yeah. It's those billboards are still around San Francisco. I think they're still surviving. And yeah, with house prices running up, they can point to that as one of the benefits that they're limited to that 2.5%, and you've seen in some places. Yeah, I think Las Vegas has been booming up again in the double digits, which I wouldn't have expected. So many things. I'm really bad at foretelling the future, especially the past 4 or 5 years. Wouldn't have guessed a lot of these things. But if you don't like that volatility, then this is something that assures you that without making a commitment. All right, that's it for this episode. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.
Thanks all.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Steve.